parts of Asia as well. So we're competing with that. And in fact, our global market share, you mentioned Adele earlier, around 2015, it was actually as high as 17% of all the music consumed around the world was by British artists. Now that figure is sort of slightly under kind of 10%. So it has become far more competitive. And that shows in the fact that, other languages are sort of coming into the mix. Interestingly, at the Brit Awards, Rosalía was one of the kind of star performances. And she obviously performs in not just Spanish, but actually apparently 14 languages. So it shows you the kind of global culture that we're in. But we still are just 1% of the world's population and account for nearly 10% of all the music consumption. So we're still doing pretty well. And I think with this next wave of British talent breaking through, the Olivias, the Lolas, Rays and others, I think we can be excited that there's an optimistic future ahead.
Okay, we're obviously punching above our weight. Last 10 seconds. What artists should we be looking out for next year?
Oh gosh, there's a rapper from Liverpool called SD Kid that everyone's getting very excited about. That's the other thing is it's not just about London, it's about all parts of the UK developing talent and being part of that national success. So I think
Okay.
perhaps SD Kid is someone to look out for.
Okay, I'm going to be dropping his name all over the place. Thank you, Gennaro Castaldo, Director of Communications, British Recorded Music Industry. That's it from me today. Aisha Hazarikas here from 1 o'clock tomorrow. On the Times next week, Times at One next week is Mark Urban. But up next, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon.
It is 2 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio.
Coming up on our programme today, was the Boys Club of Downing Street to blame for the disastrous appointment of Peter Mandelson? Labour watcher Rachel Cunliffe will join us for that. Oil prices are rising as Iran continues to attack ships in the Persian Gulf. We're going to talk to the journalist and author David K. Johnston about how long the US can sustain a war. The return of Brits from Dubai is benefiting one sector, estate agents. We'll hear more from the Times property team in a moment. And our big interview after 3:30. I really hope you can stay with us to listen to this. This is with the campaigners, the water pollution campaigners, portrayed in the Channel 4 docudrama Dirty Business.
Here's the news at 2 o'clock, James Kitchen.
Iran's new supreme leader has released his first statement warning all US bases in the region should immediately be closed or face being attacked. Mujtaba Khamenei vowed to avenge martyrs and said the closure of the Strait of Hormuz would continue as a tool to pressure the US and Israel. He also called for unity among the Iranian population and acknowledged the strain they have felt. The Sun is reporting the new leader was critically wounded in recent US-Israeli strikes, with a source telling the paper he's in intensive care. It comes as the world's energy watchdog is warning the war has created the largest supply disruption in the history of the global oil market. Brent crude topped $100 a barrel again overnight after Iran appeared to carry out further attacks on cargo ships in the Gulf. Two tankers were hit off the coast of Iraq while a container ship was struck near the UAE. It comes as the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper touches down in Saudi Arabia in what the government calls a show of UK support for allies in the region. Senior Associate Fellow at RUSI Michael Stevens told Times Radio Tehran is causing maximum disruption for minimal cost.
The Iranians have certainly made the calculation that whenever it looks like Trump is going to declare victory, they just keep him entertained a little bit longer. They just keep the problem going a little bit longer and they maximise the disruption. And this seems to be their tactic. Cling on in there, bat for a draw for those of you that follow cricket. And that's what they're essentially doing. They're not losing. They're never going to win. They're not losing. And the longer that they don't lose, the more time the US spends sucked into keeping the straits open.
The Conservative leader has accused Sir Keir Starmer of misleading MPs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as British ambassador to Washington. The Prime Minister told the Commons three times full due process had been followed when asked about the peer's selection last year. But documents released yesterday showed Lord Mandelson had access to classified information before his security clearance had been granted. They also revealed the National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, raised concerns about the reputational risk of the appointment, warning it had been weirdly rushed. Times Radio's Adam Bolton says it comes down to what the PM knew and when.
Prime Minister certainly suggested to the Commons that he didn't have the full picture when he took the decision. That is true. Whether the documents published yesterday show that he had all the information at the fingertips, I don't think is proven.
Speaking to journalists in Northern Ireland this afternoon, the Prime Minister again said it was me that made the mistake in appointing Lord Mandelson. A mother of 10 who forced another woman to be her family's slave for more than 25 years has been sentenced to 13 years in prison. Amanda Wixon, who's from Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire, subjected her victim to years of abuse and made her live in squalid conditions. The woman was just 16 when she moved into the house and was regularly beaten with a broom. The inmate accused of murdering Ian Huntley has been told there'll be a pre-trial preparation hearing in April. Anthony Russell's made his first Crown Court appearance by video link from Franklin Jail near Durham. The Soham killer was attacked during a prison workshop last month. Huntley died on Saturday. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wicks Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. It is us. We are here, your centrist grands, with you on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. Did we settle for grands or nans? I can't remember.
I don't know, Jane, but I'm not as old as you, I sometimes feel that I don't want the gran on me yet.
OK, well, I'll embrace it. I'm not that bothered. OK, we're here anyway, whether people like it or not. Some of them don't. We're here until 4 o'clock. We welcome your involvement. The WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. Plenty to discuss between now and 4 o'clock. As you heard in the news bulletin there, there has been a first statement from the new supreme leader of Iran, although, as the bulletin went on to outline, we're not absolutely certain that these words have come from the man himself, are we?
Well, you would usually expect there to be a visualised address. Yeah. So that's what we've seen in the past. And the fact that he can't give that at the moment has obviously led many people to want to know a little bit more about his medical condition. And he has variously said to be either very seriously ill and actually rather incapable of giving this kind of refrain even to, you know, one of his lackeys to deliver.
Yeah.
But definitely has been injured during one of those attacks. So I think it would be fair to say that this message is everything that you would expect a message from Iran's new supreme leader to be.
Not conciliatory, is it?
Not really, Jane. No. It's following a pretty similar path.
Right. More on that a little bit later. We've got Rachel Cunliffe on the programme of The New Statesman. She can hopefully answer the big question of the day here in Britain. Can Sir Keir Starmer survive the Mandelson files? Should he? The Dubai-based Brits, we'll talk about them. They're heading back to Britain and they are looking for places to rent at eye-watering sums of money. We are talking $5,000 a week, apparently, and more. The oil price is all over the place. I was just checking. It went up and then it went down a bit. Now it's gone back up again. But how much longer will MAGA put up with Trump's war, bearing in mind that the price of what the Americans call gas matters so much to the wider population? We've got a preview of the weekend's Times magazine with Jane Mulcairns. This week, Looks Maxing, A Diary of a Heart Transplant, and a feature which asks, are all my friends having affairs? And the boat race teams have been announced. Tom Noonan with all the details and a reminder, of course, you can hear that race here on Times Radio on the big day. It's Saturday, April the 4th. And who are you talking to after 3:30?
So two incredibly important men whose names you probably don't know, Peter Hammond and Ashley Smith. So they were neighbours in a Cotswolds village. They were both there because they loved the nature and particularly the nature and the wildlife to be found in and around their local river, which was the Windrush. And they both noticed that the fish had gone away. There were no kingfishers. There were definitely no voles or otters. They wondered why that was. And that started an inquisition that they've been in charge of, directed at the water companies, which has proved to be unbelievably sinister and dark in its revelations. They are campaigners who've gone all the way to the top to try and really hold the water companies to account. And they are depicted in a new drama on Channel 4 called Dirty Business. It's just a three-parter. It really is well worth your time. And I think one of the things that both Ash and Peter would like us all to be talking more about is the fact that as customers, we cannot take our business away from these companies. So that is a huge part of why they haven't had to change their ways beforehand. We can't literally say, Thames Water, I don't like you. I'm going to go and join South Thames Water over there, who might be better. So they've held us captive. Mm. It's a very interesting interview. It is an absolutely brilliant series, and more on that after 3:30.
Okay, looking forward to that. And what else can we talk about? Well, the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon.
In at number three, Prince William wins battle to build 2,500 home development on farmland. Now, the Duchy of Cornwall has secured this planning permission for the Kent project, despite concerns that the estate is acting as a Trojan horse for urban sprawl. The second most read story, Pete Hegseth's rhetoric gives me that sinking feeling. It's a fabulous column from Hugo Rifkin, writing that when the US gloats over Iranian deaths and pumps out propaganda war videos, it isn't just their enemies who recoil. Have you seen some of the war videos that came out of the White House that were available on TikTok depicting war in a cartoon-like way?
I didn't believe they were actually
They were real.
But they were, weren't they? Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to say it's a new... have we reached the absolute pit of it all?
I thought it was a new low, Jane. I thought it was a new low.
Can't get any worse, can it?
Well, I mean, it just didn't seem to take on board at all the severity of war and the loss of life and the pain that's been caused by it. It was just remarkable and grotesque. Yeah. Iran latest is the most read piece on the Times website. Tehran sinks oil tankers in Gulf shipping lane. The price of oil remains volatile after drone strikes on a key Omani port and attacks on Iraqi waters and tankers sailing in them. Mohammed Al-Erian is Chief Economic Advisor at Allianz. He told Times Radio Breakfast that markets don't appreciate that the war can't be stopped if the US just declares victory.
There's a bit of a naivety, especially in the marketplace, on the assumption that the US can declare victory at any stage, which it can, and therefore Iran and Israel will follow suit. But the reality is there are different objectives. And secondly, the so-called asymmetrical warfare, where you have drones, and in a situation where you've eliminated the top leadership, means that decisions have been delegated down to field commanders, and they can make decisions very easily based on opportunistic targets.
Well, you heard a little bit of Stig Abel there in the background. You can hear all of him in the foreground. Times Radio Breakfast with Stig and Kate every Monday through to Thursday from 6 until 10. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. I just can't believe that anybody doesn't have one by now.
I'm just having another look at this statement from Iran's new supreme leader. Apparently, Iran is, quotes, looking at opening other fronts. Addressing his brothers in arms, the Supreme Leader's statement added, the will of the masses is to continue the effective and regrettable defence of our country. That lever of blocking the Strait of Hormuz must definitely be used. He claimed that Iran is looking at opening other fronts where the enemy has little experience and will be extremely vulnerable, and their activation will take place if the war situation continues. That's just a little bit from the Supreme Leader's first public statement, although, as we've already said, there's no clear sign that this is actually a statement from the man himself, because he is rumoured to be very ill and possibly completely incapacitated. Anyway, keep your thoughts coming, 0333 003 2353. And let's talk about the big story here in the UK, a political story. It's the Prime Minister. He's out and about. He's in Northern Ireland today as he tries to trumpet government help for people. Actually, we mentioned them earlier in the week on our programme, people who use heating oil.
You will be watching what's happening with oil prices. And for many people, particularly here in Northern Ireland, over about two-thirds, I think, many people use oil for their heating at home. And probably many of you do as well. And you will be aware of the impact, therefore, that this could have, may already have started to have on you. Wanted to reassure you in relation to that. We've been talking to the political parties this morning. But the budget last year, we as a government set aside money to take money off people's bills for every household. The discussions we've been having this morning as to how do we, that money is made available, how do we make sure that translates as quickly as possible into money coming off your bills?
Well, he's doing his best there to plug a government policy that perhaps will have a positive impact on people. And we did talk earlier in the week, didn't we, but that the cost of heating oil had doubled, hadn't it? I think that's what people were saying.
And very, very suddenly, yeah.
Yeah. But obviously that isn't really the big story of the day. The Prime Minister, dogged by those accusations of misleading MPs over the process of appointing Peter Mandelson as US ambassador. Starmer told reporters he'd made the mistake of appointing Mandelson, and it was for him to apologise. Let's bring in Rachel Cunliffe, who's a long-time Labour watcher and associate political editor of The New Statesman. Hello, Rachel.
Afternoon, hi.
Now, I'm just looking at some copy about what Sir Keir Starmer's been saying. He said the release of the information shows what was known. That led to further questions being asked. Unfortunately, because of the Met Police investigation, we can't release that information yet, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it was me that made a mistake, and it's me that makes the apology to the victims of Epstein, and I do that. OK, so that's the latest from the Prime Minister out and about today. Rachel, is it enough?
Well, firstly, let's talk about what we've learned this week, because it was a bit of an anticlimax. We thought we're going to get the first tranche of the Mandelson files, as they're being called. But actually, as you say, a key document, possibly, you know, the key document, which is the document that the Prime Minister has said shows that Peter Mandelson lied when he was asked those questions, that's not included. That's because the Met Police is still investigating. We'll get that document at a later stage. So actually what we got this week was just confirmation of mostly what we already knew, what had already been reported, and what the Prime Minister had already admitted. So I think the key thing is that Starmer's line on Peter Mandelson has changed. Initially, he said, you know, full due process was followed at all points. Then on the 4th of February at PMQs, he was really backed into a corner and forced to reveal that the vetting that he had received as part of that appointment process had mentioned Peter Mandelson's ongoing friendship with Jeffrey Epstein after Epstein's sexual conviction in 2008. And we kind of knew that, that was in the public domain, but sort of hearing it confirmed that that was mentioned in the vetting documents, we got that confirmed yesterday as well. That is a big error of judgment and a question of judgment, because that shows that even without all the other information that we're hoping that will come soon, it was definitively the case that Starmer was warned about Mandelson and Epstein and chose to go ahead with the appointment anyway.
Yeah, and it is interesting, certainly from our perspective, that women do not feature all that prominently in the Mandelson files. And we know that in the past, Sir Keir Starmer has been accused of running a little bit of a boys' club operation. And it is also notable that Karen Pearce, who was Britain's ambassador to Washington, does feature in the files and emerges as one of the few individuals who warned that the association that Mandelson had with Epstein would be a problem. Now, has that boys' club thing simply been confirmed by all this, do you think?
I think it certainly doesn't help. So I read the Epstein, the Mandelson files yesterday, and I was struck by the lack of women's names involved. And there doesn't seem to have been a discussion anywhere where the specific issue of Mandelson's friendship with Epstein and the victims and the reputational damage of that friendship has been discussed. Maybe there was a meeting, maybe there was a conversation that we don't know about, but it really struck me that it's all really men talking about to what extent they think this is an issue and deciding on the basis of evidence that we haven't seen that it's not one. Now, there's some exceptions to that. Jonathan Powell warned against the appointment. He said the appointment process was weirdly rushed, which we might return to when we have more evidence of, you know, what the actual stages were. Keir Starmer's obviously talked about the vetting being insufficient in not raising more of the details that have subsequently come to light. But I do think it's striking that there aren't women in those conversations. And I do think it's striking that what was already known at the time, that this relationship had continued with everything that had subsequently come out about Epstein, wasn't deemed to be a problem, especially for a prime minister who built his pre-politics career, yeah, on championing victims.
Yes, and banging on. And look, I mean, I appreciate this very much, going on and on about how important it was to try to do something about the high levels of violence against women and girls. We've got a quote here from a long-time Labour activist who told somebody associated with the programme that if you ask any of the many women who were involved in Keir's leadership campaign and then found themselves out on their ear, They would say the rot started well before he got to number 10. So has that been your experience? Do you know that women were effectively, I don't know, just got rid of before they got into power?
I know that women who looked like they were going to be in line for senior jobs, when those jobs came to be handed out, were no longer in line for them. And I want to be careful about sort of not naming names, but there has been a pattern that women who have worked in and around the Labour campaign have spotted and have talked about doing the work, whether it's in opposition or whether it's doing deputy roles and being very highly respected and well thought of, then when those jobs come up, being overlooked. And I think if you look at jobs like Director of Communications, Chief of Staff, even the discussions that Keir Starmer was having about who he wanted to be head of the civil service, there were lots of senior, accomplished, qualified women in the running for those jobs. When it came to it, they all went to men. Now, not saying that women are inherently better, more talented, even more ethical than men are. And certainly, I think women are going to have their own, individuals are going to have their own scandals and baggage or grievances against them, whatever. But I do think that possibly a conversation about this is the specific reputational risk, somebody who we want to appoint to the highest ambassadorial position, diplomatic position that we have, had continued a friendship with a man with a paedophilia conviction after that conviction. Do we think this is a problem? Does this make us look good? You might have got a bit more of a diversity of perspective there.
Yeah. Let's bring in the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch. She says the Prime Minister is actually fatally damaged and she wants him deposed. Let's listen to this.
He's been shown to have lied to the Commons. He told everyone that he did not know the full extent of Peter Mandelson's relationship with the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. And now we can see from the release of these files that that is not true. It is a shame that there are not enough opposition MPs to remove the Prime Minister. Labour MPs now need to consider their position and ask themselves, in good conscience, should this man be running our country?
Well, you can see why she makes that point. But, Rachel, it's not going to happen. There won't be a challenge to Sir Keir Starmer right now, will there? Quite apart from anything else, the obvious candidates are somewhat preoccupied or a little bit tarnished by their own association with Mandelson.
Indeed. It was an interesting comment from Kemi Badenoch. But, of course, if there were enough opposition MPs to be able to remove a Prime Minister, they wouldn't be opposition MPs. They'd be government MPs. So I thought that was a slightly odd comment. I don't think that the pressure against Keir Starmer is going to build because of this set of releases. I think there is much, much more to come. We've got to have the responses that Mandelson gave. We've also got a lot of correspondence that Mandelson had while he was ambassador that could be incredibly damaging for any number of members of the government. You know, we know the health secretary, for example, Wes Streeting, he took the step a month ago of publishing his own WhatsApp communications with Mandelson to try and get ahead of this story. So we don't know how damaging it's going to be or who is going to be damaged from it. We've also got Iran and a foreign policy and an energy crisis happening at the moment as well that possibly has Labour MPs thinking, should we wait until the situation's a bit clearer there? But even with all of that, you can't get away from the fact that this is really damaging and the full extent of how many people within the Starmer government it damages isn't clear at the moment. And it has implications for both how long Keir Starmer can remain in his position, but also how the different factions looking to perhaps possibly replace him, how those factions revolve around their candidates, who is up, who is down. We don't have enough information yet. All we know is that more information is going to come out and it could shake things up completely.
Yeah, and perhaps some of his potential successors are quite happy to leave Iran to him. Let Sir Keir Starmer take the heat for all this. Because at the moment we're in a slightly odd position. We're not involved, but we are involved.
Yes, and where the Prime Minister's position on Iran is broadly in line with where the public are at the moment, but the second that the energy bills start rising and petrol prices start rising, there's going to be pressure on the government to do something, to act, as we saw after in 2022 with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There isn't really enough money to act in a way that is going to alleviate those cost pressures on everyone. So I think if you were looking to possibly be Keir Starmer's successor. You might want to see how that situation developed before toppling him just yet.
Appreciate your time, Rachel. Thank you. Rachel Cunliffe is Associate Political Editor of The New Statesman.
22 minutes past two, coming up as thousands of Brits rush back from Dubai. Who might the winners be here at home? You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Ed Vasey on Times Radio, reviewing the week in politics from Westminster and beyond.
This is the kind of most interesting thing, I guess, about what is going on in British politics at the moment.
The daily political debrief with a difference.
Oh no, more crypto-commie pro-Labour Vasey.
Plus a peerless lineup of guests and commentators.
He, like me, and indeed like most of our listeners, is a bit of a political junkie.
Ed Vasey, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
At TUI, we give you more. More outfit choices with 20 kilograms of luggage allowance as standard. More hotels built around what you love, like that swim-up suite. More race you to the bottom, water parks on site. More, ooh, that looks good, food options from poolside snacks to a la carte dining. Book on app, in-store or online. You book it, TUI sort it. Atoll and APTA protected. T's and C's apply. Selected hotels only. See website for details.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Transform your kitchen or bathroom. Wix has everything you need, plus all the finishing touches, from beautiful tiles and flooring to a wide choice in paint and lighting. Whatever you're planning, create the perfect space with Wix.
Now, where are the Brits who moved to Dubai heading to now? Well, luxury property agents have received a flurry of calls. It's a delicious piece of journalese there. From UK nationals who settled in the Emirate looking to arrange emergency £5,000 a week rentals in London. It comes as many residents have been left frightened by drone attacks from Iran and sudden freedom of speech clampdowns. Let's talk to David Byers, Deputy Property Editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. Now, when we say a flurry of calls, do we have some statistics about this, David?
Well, agents say there's been a sort of 15% rise in inquiries from the UAE since the Iran war began. So I think we can probably talk about a few dozen, I'd say, at this stage. This is luxury London agents looking to resettle, and that's towards the higher end of the market. So we're talking about rentals at £5,000 a week, which is roughly £260,000 a year. As one agent said in St John's Wood office at Beecham Estates, she's getting a notable increase in people calling her looking for a way out.
Now, I know that £5,000 a week is an astonishing amount of money.
It's completely normal.
But actually, in the context of luxury London living, where does that figure lie?
It's what you call the prime market. So, for example, you'd get a four-bedroom property in Kensington, Chelsea, Notting Hill or Holland Park at that sort of money. So I would say it's at the top end. There are higher end properties still. I mean, you know, we mentioned a few properties. You know, there's a townhouse in Brompton Square, Knightsbridge, costing £18,500 a week that we've mentioned in the piece. There are places that are more expensive than that, but it's a pretty high benchmark.
Now, we often talk about problems at the bottom end of the rental market, David, and people who can't afford to get into flats, or, you know, there are 20 applicants for a £1,000 a month flat. Is it different at the top end of the market, that actually there are quite a lot of these properties available if you suddenly want to come to the UK?
Yeah, I think there are quite a lot of these properties available now. And part of that is because the London market at the high end has been hampered, really, in the last few years by lack of demand. You know, there's been stamp duty increases that mean that, for example, if you want to buy a property, overseas buyers now have to pay as much as 19%. And you've had the non-dom changes, which mean that non-dom status has been abolished from April last year by Rachel Reeves, which used to allow wealthy residents to avoid paying tax on their overseas income. So the London market had a pretty miserable time. According to Knight Frank, It's had a 4.8% price drop at the top end over the last year. So all of that means there are quite a lot of properties going around, a lot of rentals that are currently empty, a lot of properties for sale that aren't selling. So if you want into London, it's not a bad time for it.
Obviously, there'll be so many other people who aren't in that kind of high-end bracket. I mean, their fate is far less certain.
Yep.
Their return here would be far, far harder to do, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at the moment, of course, airspace is sort of mostly closed anyway, coming from the UAE. And I think the thing is, it's not all sort of, people joke about influencers and joke about people who live for Instagram and so forth. And there's a fair amount of that in Dubai. But there are also plenty of people who are just doing ordinary jobs who thought they'd go out there and make a bit of money and pay less tax. And, you know, one person I spoke to said that he's got a client who runs an FX currency trading business, got a big office in Dubai, loads of young professionals there. They all want to come back. They all tell him that, you know, with what's gone on, it's taken the shine off. He doesn't think any of them are going to come back. So you could accuse these people of gross naivety, I suppose. They've just realised they're in the Middle East, and in some areas of Dubai are only 100 miles away from Iran. On the other hand, of course, these are people who might be coming back with a tail between their legs and might genuinely be quite scared. Yeah. So
we've had a very interesting text from one of our regular listeners, and you've asked to remain anonymous, and that's totally fine by us. He's feeling quite frustrated by this type of story emerging in the press. She says the focus on the minority of high net worth individuals, the latest report today that expats are seeking £5,000 a week rentals, is feeding the urban myths about British immigrants to Dubai all being influencers and rolling in money. My family have lived in Dubai for nearly 20 years, working hard just to provide a home and upbringing for their family. They've got good jobs, but they're not making anything like the fantastical sums that the Times would have you believe. My brother works for Emirates Airline and has been working night and day to get planes in the sky safely and to get people home. Of course, that is the reality for the vast majority of people who've gone to Dubai in order to find a better life for themselves and their family. We are always going to do an eye-catching story like this, David, and I think make no apology for it, actually.
Yeah.
Well, it is tempting because it provides a little bit of insight into a world that is usually very closed to the rest of us, actually. Mm. I'm not sure that I've ever stood in a £5,000 a week apartment or house. Have you, Jane?
Surprise me.
I haven't, no. No, but we do like to look at that kind of bling aspect, so this is interesting.
No, I think
us.
You're right, and I think there's, as you've said, there are 240,000 people with British passports living in the UAE. And so there are a large number. It isn't just the high end. I think the one thing that is taking people by surprise maybe in Dubai, and arguably it shouldn't, is this idea that you mustn't post things on social media the government doesn't want you to post. Mm. It's okay if you post a picture of yourself in a bikini on a beach or flexing your muscles on some sort of amazing Instagrammable viewpoint. But what was flashing up on people's phones after the first strikes from Iran was the UAE government saying that if you post anything that's not official of the war, you know, including shrapnel falling or drones that isn't sanctioned by the government, then it's illegal and they'll come after you. And, you know, there was a report today that that somebody has actually been arrested for posting, a British national, for posting Instagram shots of an Iranian drone falling in Dubai. So I think that has taken people by surprise, that people had sort of rose-tinted glasses a little bit, that this is a country which could make them a lot of money. This is a country where, you know, it's the weather's lovely and the tax is low and the developments are luxurious. But in fact, it is a very, very volatile reason, a very volatile region, should I say, and there isn't freedom of speech. And this, I think, is coming home to a lot of people. The freedom of speech element is going to be a big thing. And I think when it comes to people moving out to Dubai in future, there'll be a realisation, I think, of that thing, that the freedom of speech is restrained.
Absolutely, and what a test it is at the moment. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah. David Byers is Deputy Property Editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. I know that you've got another story out today about doer-uppers, but maybe we could save that till next week. I'll have a story about property makeover.
I'll come back.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Right, next we're going to find out about the sisters competing against each other in this year's boat race. That's a family with proper great genes, isn't it?
It's also a recipe for disaster.
Yes, and that, actually. Sibling rivalry on the River Thames. We'll find out more in a moment. Here are the headlines just after 2:30, James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon.
Donald Trump has branded Iran an evil empire and pledged never to allow the country to build nuclear weapons. The president's intervention comes after Iran's new supreme leader warned all U.S. bases in the region should immediately be closed or face being attacked. Mujtaba Khamenei vowed to avenge martyrs and said the closure of the Strait of Hormuz would continue as a tool to pressure the U.S. and Israel. Oil prices have briefly jumped above $100 again, despite the world's energy watchdog announcing the release of millions of reserve barrels. It follows new Iranian attacks on ships in the Middle East, including two tankers off the coast of Iraq. Vandana Hari is the founder of Vanda Insights, which analyzes activity in the energy markets.
The big question really is at what rate that oil is going to be released. By our calculations, perhaps at the rate of about 3 to 4 million barrels per day. So put that number against the 20 million barrel per day hole that is being created every day that this war goes on.
The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch has accused Sir Keir Starmer of misleading MPs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as British ambassador to Washington. The Prime Minister told the Commons three times full due process had been followed when asked about the peers selection last year. But documents released yesterday showed Lord Mandelson had access to classified information before his security clearance had been granted. Speaking to journalists in Northern Ireland this afternoon, the Prime Minister said it was me that made the mistake in the appointment. A woman's been jailed for 13 years for forcing a teenage girl to work as a house slave for a quarter of a century. 56-year-old Amanda Wixon subjected her victim to years of abuse at a home in Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it, it's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
From the first note to the final twist, Rigoletto delivers iconic music and a gripping story at the Royal Opera House. Lust, betrayal, and revenge combine in this unforgettable five-star production featuring a world-class cast. Rigoletto returns from the 25th of March to the 23rd of April. Dare to be moved. Book today at rbo.org.uk.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Just a very quick correction. Airspace around Dubai and going out of Dubai Airport isn't shut. It's very, very busy. I tell you what, we'd be very interested in hearing from people who are travelling to Dubai at the moment. There is, of course, a mass exodus going on. Yeah. I wonder how full the planes are when they're going back there.
Well, I'm just looking. There are flights currently scheduled to leave Dubai to New Delhi, to Mumbai, to Shanghai, Addis Ababa, Amman, Jeddah. Right. So, but not... As far as I can make out, not to Western Europe.
So a different route is having to be taken. A lot of people have contacted us, haven't they, over the last week to say they're having to fly via China.
To get back.
Yes, in order to go back. So let's talk to John Pienaar, who takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Hello, John.
Hi there. So looking at this question from different points of view, does it make sense? The answer to this surely is no, to wage war on a country, even when you're deemed to be a major threat, without a plan. Now, President Trump, we hear now every day telling us that the war is as good as won. And everyone around him says there is a crystal clear plan. But objectively, you look at it and that really seems not to be the case. And I'm going to be talking to people with different takes on that, including Sir Simon Gass, who's a former British ambassador to Iran. I'm talking to Aaron David Miller. He's a former US State Department Middle East negotiator. Always worth a conversation with Aaron David Miller. And I'm also talking to Lord Brown, who's the former boss of BP, about, look, we look at the disruption in the energy economy around the world right now. What can be done? What needs to be done? Just to try and build some sort of hedge or protection against that for the future, against threats still to come. And against that background, does it make sense to sort of start to squeeze the taps off on North Sea oil? So we'll get his talk on that. Richard Spencer is in Iraq. We'll hear from him and other things too. But I'm also, you know, in the course of the show, going to be looking at really, really posh restaurants. So you saw the story in the Times today that the restaurant in Paris, the oldest possessor in Paris of three Michelin stars, which is, you know, is as high as you get, has lost one of those stars. And I remembered reading what I thought was an absolutely hilarious a column by Giles Corran the other day in reviewing another restaurant, where he just casually said that Michelin stars don't float his boat. So I want to know, what is it then with Michelin stars? Why don't they float your boat? Why do they float so many people's boat the way that they do? There have been tales of chefs and restaurateurs who contemplated suicide at the idea of losing a Michelin star. Look, I don't go to Michelin restaurants because, you know, I don't instantly want to spend 500 quid on lunch. But, you know,
yeah, no, I'm with you, John. And actually, if you don't like your food incredibly rich, the Michelin star can very, very accurately identify restaurants to avoid, restaurants to visit.
I don't even know that. I watch MasterChef, you know, that sort of stuff. And they go on and on about Michelin stars, and some of the plates look absolutely wonderful, but I don't quite get where the lines are drawn between, you know, degrees of quality and unbelievable
yeah,
quality.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
That'll be fun to listen to. John, thank you very much indeed. John takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Are you a Michelin star?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that.
Yeah.
I've had a few. I haven't had a few today. Actually, I think they can be, as I'm with you, too rich, too unctuous, simply too much. I have been to one of those tasting menu restaurants, and I remember just thinking that I was bored with the company of my companion as we munched our way through, what was it, 12 courses of...
When did that little thought pass your brain?
It was a while ago. We're not going to get...
No, it was at course number two.
Oh, I see. Yes, definitely. Might have been the beginning of the first starter. There might have been, you know, the amuse-bouche.
Right. I don't want to condemn all Michelin restaurants because I think some of them are absolutely fabulous. But yeah. But the idea that it automatically it's going to be a wonderful cuisine that you enjoy, that's not what it says to me at all. I think you have to check the recipe quite carefully.
Absolutely.
The crews for this year's Oxford and Cambridge boat race have been announced today. You'll be able to get live commentary of the race itself exclusively here on Times Radio on the 4th of April. Tom Noonan, one of Times Radio's boat race reporters, joins us now live from Somerset House, where he's been getting all of the reactions. Give us the headlines, Tom. What are the most notable announcements? And boy, do you look smart.
Thank you very much, Free. That's very kind. It's not quite as smart as all of the rowers who are lined up in their blazers, which I think were heavy enough to fight against the wind. It's been quite a blustery day at Somerset House. If it's like this on the day, it'll be quite an unpleasant race. It'll be even more arduous than it already is for the rowers. The headline comes in the women's race, and we think it is the first time that two sisters have competed against each other in the boat race. So you've got Lily Frysham and Mia Frysham. Lily's the older sister. She is with Oxford. She already rowed. She got a blue last year. She was in that losing crew. And now Mia, who only found out about the race through her sister being involved in the reserve crews for the last couple of years before graduating into the main blue boat, Mia is now on the Cambridge side. So, yeah, we spoke to them a little earlier about, you know, the way their family and are going to be, which side they'll be supporting or not, but that's the most interesting story from this selection.
Right, I think we can hear a little bit from Mia. As Tom just said, she's competing for Cambridge. I think she's going to tell us a bit about how her and her sister got into rowing.
We didn't grow up with rowing at all. We had no rowing connection until we both started rowing in Edinburgh together. And then about a year and a half afterwards, Lily started her PhD at Oxford and she said to me, oh, I heard they also row. And then they do. So on, what was it, April 2023, we went down to watch her first reserve race. And I just vividly remember being on the banks and seeing the crowds and everything and thinking, wow, this is incredible. And this is something that is so unique in the sport of rowing that you can't find it anywhere else.
Now, they also spoke about how there will be a silver lining for the sister who ends up in the losing team.
However way it turns, I think we'll give it our all on the water, and then knowing us, we'll get out of the boat and give each other a hug 2 seconds later. So,
and I mean, losing the boat race is never fun, but if you get to get off the water and knowing that one of the people that knows you the best in the world and probably one of the people that you wish the best for got to win it, I mean, we'll give everything we can, but if there is anything that can make it better, it's that.
Right, well, it will be fascinating to watch just for that familial relationship to be exposed. Now, Tom, is it true that none of Oxford's men have rowed in a boat race before?
Yes, so none of them have rowed in the boat race before. Some of them have rowed in the reserves, but none of them have won in the reserves because Cambridge, on both the men's and the women's side, have been pretty dominant in the last few years. So the only member of the Oxford crew who has been involved in the boat race before is Tobias Bernard, who's the president, and the cox. He grew up coxing on the river, so he knows the course really well, which could be crucial on the day, because much more so than in, you know, usual Olympic rowing, which happens on a straight course, 2,000 metres on a lake, the cox comes into it so much more because of finding the right racing line. How do you keep them going when you lose sight of your opponent? It's such a binary race. If you lose it, then it can be pretty gutting. But yeah, so he is the only bit of experience there, and none of them have tasted a victory in either the reserve or the main boat race. On the Cambridge side, it's only the bow pair that have experience, the president, Noam Moyel, and Simon Hatcher. So pretty fresh. Whereas the Oxford women, incredibly experienced team. You know, five of them have rowed in a boat race before. Five of them all last year from the same crew, even though they lost. And the ones who haven't have, you know, immense experience at an international level. As well.
Right. Oxford women haven't won for 10 years, have they? And I think somebody said yesterday, you know, it's kind of their turn.
Well, that's what I said. Okay, it's
said
logical.
Someone. Just you. But it doesn't really work like that, Tom, does it?
I don't think Cambridge will be that charitable, I'll be honest, speaking to them today. I mean, on the flip side, you've got Gemma King, who's the president of Cambridge. They're a much less experienced crew, but Gemma, this will be her seventh race of either lightweights, reserves, or sort of a full blue, as they call the sort of the main race. I don't think she'll be willing to give it up. Yeah, they've won the last eight since 2017. There was no race in 2020 because obviously that was, you know, a couple of weeks after the lockdown started for the COVID pandemic, the first lockdown. But yeah, she knows what it's like to win. I don't think she'll be giving it up. Her twin sister is actually part of the Oxford Boat Club, not part of that crew that will be in the main blues race. But I suspect she'll want bragging rights again. I spoke to her father earlier. And yeah, she's not giving up anytime soon.
Tom, lovely stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Tom is wearing a kind of blue tweed suit for us this afternoon, which was why it was worthy of a comment. You are a South London person.
West
London person. South West London person, mainly East West Kensington person.
Yeah, that's it.
Where's the best place to go to watch the boat race?
I've lived in that part of London for many years now. I have never been.
Oh.
Partly because, well, we may as well do the old joke from Robert, why do the same teams always get to the final? I'm with you, Robert. I mean, Robert's in Manchester. If Birmingham did make the boat race, I'd have gone down years ago. I absolutely would. My kids have always gone, just I'm afraid they've just gone to drink. And I imagine they'll be doing the same this year. But I've never been. But Guess what?
What?
I'm going.
Brilliant.
I'm going this year because I want to be part of the Jane Mulkerin's Times Radio experience. She's doing the coverage.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
So is it better, though, to be on what would be the north bank of the Thames or the south bank, or does it not make any difference, really?
Fee, you are testing me this afternoon.
You might know if you're going.
Just sit in the pub and listen to Times Radio.
Right. I hope we've been informative. I don't think we have been. Right, coming up, a sneak peek into the pages of the Times magazine. What exactly is looks maxing? That's where we're going to go next. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's the pinnacle event of the jump racing calendar, the Cheltenham Festival. And from the excitement of Champion Day all the way to the unforgettable drama of Gold Cup Day, Times Radio will keep you up to date with all the action and results as they happen. Cheltenham Festival updates throughout the festival on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18 plus, gambleaware.org.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Here she is, our own little water nymph. It's Jane Mulkerin, here to plug not just the Times magazine, but her coverage of the boat race. So it's April the 4th. It's Saturday.
Yeah. They have timed the race specifically to coincide with my new show.
Wonderful.
It's really kind of them to do it, yeah. Absolutely nothing to do with tide times, of course. Funny you said water nymph, actually, Jane, because...
is it?
When I was at one of those universities competing, I was president of the Newhall Nymphs, which was the Female Drinking Society.
Oh, I thought you were...
So I am perfectly qualified to host the boat race coverage.
But because you went to Cambridge, does it mean that you genuinely do have a vested interest? Could you ever go along and just watch it as kind of a sporting event? Do you feel the pull?
I mean, you know, I've got a whole wardrobe of light blue that I won't be wearing on the day, Fee, because I can put aside all of my deep-held sporting commitment to my alma mater.
Jane, you're bigging up your programme.
Yes, but I'm trying to say I'll be very, very impartial.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm actually genuinely, I'm quite interested to see what the atmosphere is like down there.
It's really fun. Yeah, it's such a fun day.
Mm. There's no trouble, is there, at the boat race?
Somebody might occasionally spill a Pimm's on their blazer.
Right.
Things can get very out of hand. Okay. No, it's a brilliant, brilliant atmosphere. I mean, whether you really care about rowing or the results, you know, and who wins either way, it's a brilliant, brilliant day out. It is a great atmosphere. And, you know, genuinely, those people are really fit and really sporty. I mean, the boat race is full of, you know, very well-honed athletes who are very at the top of their stroke.
Yeah, and also, lest we forget, most of them very clever as well, able young people.
Yep, yep. Absolutely. None of them have been drafted in because of their sporting prowess to the university.
It provides an opportunity, doesn't it, Jane? That's
exactly
what we call it these days.
Yes, it's an opportunity. Yeah. But I think what it's really good because we're covering both the men's and the women's race. There's going to be, I don't know whether we've announced it yet, but there is some fun in the women's boat in that two relatives are facing
You obviously haven't been listening.
Oh, no, I'm doing my other job downstairs, Jane. I'm not allowed to have you on distracting me when I'm putting together a magazine.
Who works in an office without the radio on?
People at the Times. Well, we have pictures of you. We just can't hear you.
Well, even back at the old mothership, Radio 4's offices never had Radio 4 on.
Oh, no, but that was like...
No, they didn't. It was weird.
It was weird. It was like
really
being
weird.
A silent retreat. Yeah.
I think everybody in their headphones was listening to Heart FM.
That's just you, I think.
I can't see you. I'm learning to lip read downstairs on the monitors.
Never do that.
No, that's true.
Right, do you want to tell us about your proper job?
But yeah, tell you what I've been doing downstairs all day.
Go on, then.
I'm not listening to you. So the magazine... The magazine has a big cover story, which is so big that we can't talk about it yet. But you will be able to read it online from 6 p.m. tomorrow and then obviously in the magazine on Saturday morning. But there is lots else in the magazine that we can talk about, including this absolutely extraordinary story about face maxing. If you've never heard of face maxing and you've got a young man in your life in his teens or 20s, you probably should learn about it because it's this incredibly worrying trend in extreme beauty amongst young men. The word comes from maxing your looks. And it's this sort of ever-expanding industry. It involves weight loss drugs that are not even licensed yet that people are buying online. It involves all manner of supplements and courses and protein meal plans. But it also involves breaking bits of your own jaw and smashing yourself in the face in order to kind of achieve this hyper-masculine aesthetic, which apparently all of these influencers are serving up on the algorithm. It has been likened by some of these psychologists to anorexia in women because you're chasing something that's forever unachievable, and obviously you're doing extraordinary damage to yourself at the same time. But it is a huge industry, and these people have hundreds of thousands of followers. It is quite bonkers to me. It grew out of the incel movement and the idea of chads, these men with perfect jaws. But now it seems like all of these men are practicing some sort of strange aesthetic determinism where, you know, success in life and certainly success in romantic life is apparently determined by the cut of your jaw.
I mean, it is truly terrifying. And I think there's an end sentence to this article. At its best, looks maxing is simply self-improvement in a new dialect. At its worst, it's teaching a generation of boys to see their faces as problems to be solved. Well, I mean, you read that and you think, well, welcome to our world, because every single girl is brought up and, you know, you get products absolutely, you're bombarded with things that can make you look less terrible. That's capitalism, isn't it? But this seems to be actually a more extreme and more destructive version of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interventionist to the extreme and very extreme. If, you know, this is men basically self-harming their own faces. It's really, really strange. And there's some really disturbing quotes. There's this guy called Johan Drumov, who is a 21-year-old model from Sweden, who says he's a heavy looks maxer, and he reels with his shopping list of surgical procedures. He's only 21. And he says, you know, all of this thing, fat grafting under the eyes, palate expansion to widen the jawline. They're small flaws, but when combined together, it improves me as a whole. He says he's not doing it because he hates himself. He's got a good life and he loves his life, but that he wants to mog, which means upstaging other people around you. He says, I want to feel better to improve. Even if it's unnatural, I don't care. Most exceptional looking people are not natural, he says. And then the writer asks if he's got a girlfriend, and he says, no, I'm single for now. Once I've ascended more, yes, maybe then. It's just the language I find really disturbing. It's very manospheric, this language.
Yeah. Do these young people not think that if they're lucky, they could one day be 85?
Well, exactly.
And will they still be keeping this up?
Punching themselves in the face when they're 85.
Will they look like? I mean, anyway, sorry.
Well, the other thing is I can't think of anything worse than trying to go on a date with any of these people. I mean, someone who's chewing on a towel to expand their own jawline and punching themselves in the face. It just doesn't sound very fun. I'm not sure that they'd have the sort of intellectual rigor you'd want over dinner. Well, they probably wouldn't eat dinner.
You wouldn't want to go to a Michelin restaurant with them, that's for sure. Right, we were talking about that earlier. I know you weren't listening. I found this really interesting. Diary of a Heart Transplant by a great writer. It's Christy Watson. I think she's got a thriller out now, hasn't she? But she's also the author of a book I thought was great. It's called The Language of Kindness.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think is so disturbing about this looks maxing thing is that the idea that people would subject themselves to so many unnecessary surgeries.
Right.
You know, when this piece that Christy Watson has written, really compelling and moving piece about her husband's heart transplant, and everything, you know, she's a former nurse, so she thought that she was sort of au fait with things like transplants and operations. And it just, she talks about just how much she didn't know and how hard it was and all the things she couldn't have imagined. So her husband was 47 and they'd only been married for a year when he was told he needed a heart transplant. And they've got this kind of amazing love story. They knew each other as children and then drifted apart and then were thrown together in their 40s and really fell in love. Have got a blended family of sort of four young adults between them, were really happy and felt very privileged to have found each other later on. And then, he had this congenital heart condition and needed a transplant. And she talks about joining the transplant community, which she says is a club you'd never want to be part of, and learning the truth about transplants. Because I think we're all sort of led to believe that it's a bit of a golden ticket when you have a transplant. It'll be fine then. And she says, you know, the people climbing mountains or running marathons are actually the anomaly, and that it's very, very hard,
even when you've had a transplant. The recovery is very hard. The chance of rejection is very high. You know, you need regular biopsies. There are things like, you know, you're 100 times more likely to develop skin cancer. You know, all of these kind of side effects. But that they said for him that without the transplant, he would die. So essentially, there wasn't really a choice in the matter.
And there's one terrible episode where he nearly had an operation, but then they had to cancel it.
Because he had a high temperature.
Yeah.
And he then had all these enormous feelings of guilt about the fact that there was a heart for him, which someone had donated, but that because he was, you know, just not very well, the heart would then not go to anyone else. And so it's a roller coaster that she writes about really, really beautifully. And she just sort of says, you know, it's when you think about all the things that influence your life that are out of your control, you know, health and finances and luck. And she sort of says that actually who we choose to spend our life with can make all of those choices. You know, we can't change those things that happen to us, but no, it can make it bearable.
And also you can be helpful and make sure that your loved ones know about organ donation and your
Absolutely.
Wishes. Because we're still an opt-in country, aren't we? Quite a lot of countries are now opt-out, so they just assume that you do want to donate your organs unless you say otherwise, and we're completely the opposite. And I think that still does hold back, you know, obviously, you know, our appreciation of what it's like to be up against it like that.
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
Actually, I don't think that's right.
You think that we no? We're definitely you have to have agreed to your organs, your organ donation.
Or do you opt out? Do you sign and say you don't want them to be donated? It's one or the other.
Oh, here we are. English organ donation law has changed.
Oh,
okay.
All adults in England are now considered to have agreed to be an organ donor and when they die, unless they have recorded a decision not to donate.
Now, when was that change made? Because I'm not aware of that. Yes, stand by. But good, good information, because I'd still assumed it was completely the opposite.
I'll get back to you on that.
I mean, good luck anyone that wants my eyes or my liver, if I, you know.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Yes, I think it'd be wise if you could notify the authorities now.
I've got some other bits that are quite useful.
Yes, we'll leave J. Mulcairn's other bits, I think,
so you say,
to a different programme.
The next interesting thing I found was a lovely recipe featuring tin sardines, which I've already cut out, and I'm going to take that home and try it. There's also an article, yes, there is an article called, what's it called now? Are All My Friends Having Affairs?
I love that you just went from tinned fish to Are All My Friends Having Affairs.
To be perfectly
that's
honest,
great segue.
If it came down to it, I'm more interested in tinned fish than I am in affairs.
I know, I can see your eye rolling.
I'm just being honest.
I know you think we're obsessed with sex in the magazine, but if you read the piece, I think we're just reflecting what's going on out there, Jane, because apparently, if you believe Susanna Jowett, all of her friends are having affairs, and she's used their stories anonymously in her new novel.
Right, thank you very much. That's Jane Mulcairns, Associate Editor at The Times Magazine. I want to do a survey about how many people, like me, would prefer a recipe about tinned fish to an article about... Anyway, right. In Wales, they have to opt out. Thank you.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
We're going to do definitive details about organ donation as our first note after the news. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Still to come, Iran's new supreme leader vows to keep blocking oil shipments with prices rising. We'll head to the US to hear how long it can sustain the war effort. Vassos will bring us the sport, which is very much about tennis triumph Jack Draper. And our big interview after 3:30 is with Ash Smith and Peter Hammond, the water campaigners, newly portrayed in the docudrama on Channel 4, Dirty Business. First, the latest news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has branded Iran an evil empire and pledged never to allow the country to build nuclear weapons. The president's intervention comes after Tehran's new supreme leader warned all U.S. bases in the region should immediately close or face being attacked. Mujtaba Khamenei vowed to avenge martyrs and said the closure of the Strait of Hormuz would continue as a tool to pressure the U.S. and Israel. The Sun is reporting the new leader was critically wounded in recent U.S.-Israeli strikes, with a source telling the paper he's in intensive care. Oil prices have briefly jumped above $100 again, despite the world's energy watchdog announcing the release of millions of reserve barrels. It follows new Iranian attacks on ships in the Middle East, including two tankers off the coast of Iraq. Chief Economic Advisor at the Insurance Company Alliance, Mohammed El Arian, was asked how concerned we should be about economic damage.
Very concerned. There's
no doubt that the first impact of this war is higher energy prices and higher borrowing costs, higher interest rates, higher mortgage rates. That is phase one. As we continue, you will add to that higher inflation across the board, lower growth, and higher unemployment.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has accused Keir Starmer of misleading MPs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as British ambassador to Washington. The Prime Minister told the Commons three times full due process had been followed when asked about the peer's selection last year. But documents released yesterday showed Lord Mandelson had access to classified information before his security clearance had been granted. They also revealed the National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, raised concerns about the reputational risk, warning the process had been weirdly rushed. Speaking to journalists in Northern Ireland this afternoon, the PM said he takes full responsibility for the appointment.
Let me start where I must start, which is to accept, as I do, that I made a mistake in appointing Peter Mandelson. And let me follow that up swiftly, as I've done before, but I need to do it again, with an apology to the victims of Epstein for appointing Peter Mandelson.
The waiting list for routine hospital treatment in England has fallen for the third month in a row. At the end of January, 6.13 million patients were waiting, down from 6.17 million in December. Waits in A&E are also down, around 74% were seen within 4 hours in February, compared to an average of 72% the month before. For the first time ever, two sisters will compete against each other in the Oxford-Cambridge boat race, one of the world's oldest and most famous amateur sporting events. Atmospheric physics PhD student Lily Frischman sits at number three in the Oxford boat, while her younger sister Mia, a surgery PhD student, is at number seven in the Cambridge boat. Times Radio has full exclusive radio coverage live on the 4th of April. Speaking to the station this afternoon, Mia described how her older siblings' adventures on the water inspired her to compete too.
We went down to watch her first reserve race, and I just vividly remember being on the banks and seeing the crowds and everything and thinking, wow, this is incredible, and this is something that is so unique in the sport of rowing that you can't find it anywhere else.
For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 4 minutes past three. You're listening to Fee Glover. This one, and that one over there is Jane Garvey, and we're with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We're going to talk about water pollution in this country and two extraordinary campaigners who've spent the last decade highlighting it. That will happen after 3:30 on the programme. Some news just in about a British base being hit by Iranian drones.
Yes, this is a British base in Iraq hit by Iranian kamikaze drones. This is thought to be the third successful strike against UK forces since the start of the war. We're told that some American troops have been hurt, but there were no British casualties. Specialist counter-drone troops use surface-to-air missiles to destroy two unmanned aerial systems heading for this coalition camp in Erbil, which is in northern Iraq. It was overnight on Wednesday, so last night. An unknown number of the one-way attack bombs made it past their air defences. However, they struck the base and injured American troops stationed there, but they were not seriously harmed. So that is just news, I suppose, of, more British involvement, or certainly more another impact on a British base, in this case in Iraq, and the war continues. And in fact, we're going on to talk about that now, aren't we?
We are. Just a quick update, and to clarify, England organ donation law has changed. All adults in England are now considered to have agreed to be an organ donor when they die, unless they have recorded a decision not to donate. In Wales, it's deemed consent, same kind of thing. It's called deemed authorisation in Scotland. It doesn't apply on the Isle of Man, and Northern Ireland has changed to an opt-out system. So I hope that that has left you with some clarity, maybe some confusion too.
Well, I mean, basically, it would seem that across Britain, across the British Isles, if you don't want to donate an organ, you better say so.
Yes, but there is a clause, isn't there, about families still having a say in your organ donation as well.
I mean, I would certainly not give a fig, which whatever anybody wanted to harvest from me after I was gone, I would say, take whatever you like. And I think I've told my children that. And I think that's probably the best thing to do, isn't it? Just
Have the conversation. Yeah. Just have had the conversation, so it's not something that they think in the moment, oh, I'm not quite sure. You know what Mum would have wanted. So I think it's in some families it's a very difficult conversation to have.
Of course.
7 minutes past three. Oil prices have surged once again, nearing $100 a barrel, following a wave of Iranian strikes on economic targets across the Middle East. The country's supreme leader is vowing to continue blocking oil tankers by keeping the vital Strait of Hormuz closed. The escalation comes after President Trump's rally in Kentucky last night, where he vowed to finish the job in the ongoing military campaign and said oil prices would soon come back down.
The market's holding up well. I figured we'd be hit a little bit, but we were hit probably less than I thought, and we'll be back on track in a pretty short while. Prices are coming down very substantially. Oil will be coming down. That's just a matter of war that happens very, you can almost predict it. I would say it went up a little bit less than we thought. It's going to come down more than anybody understands.
But as the America First president continues to lead the country through a major conflict, questions are mounting over how the US public and the US economy is going to bear the cost. Let's talk about all of that with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Making of Donald Trump. A very good afternoon from us in London. Can I start with a bit of an overview from you about how Operation Epic Fury actually squares with the image and the manifesto that President Trump sold to his fan base?
Well, Fee, thank you and Jane for having me on. Donald ran for president in 2024, promising no more wars overseas. Back in 2011, when he dallied with the idea of running for president, he said that the only way Barack Obama could get reelected was by starting a war with Iran because he's an incompetent negotiator. And what we've seen is, of course, Donald, who I've negotiated with many times, is a terrible negotiator. He has turned to this epic fury as primarily a distraction from the Epstein files. More and more is coming out every day, connecting Donald to the allegations of child rape by Epstein and his friends. And Donald, of course, has said that Epstein was, for a number of years, his best friend. The MAGA group, which is 20 to 25% of the American public, they voted for him on two big promises. I'll release the Epstein files in full. There's no reason not to. And there will be no more endless wars. We're not going to get into a war. Both of those have been broken. He also claimed there would be huge drops in prices. Drug prices are going to go down 1,500%. An indication of how Donald doesn't understand basic math. And of course, prices in the U.S. are rising at slightly higher rate than the when he came into office. They certainly aren't ruinous. They're at the moment just below the post-World War II average in the U.S.
Right.
But the U.S. economy has stopped adding jobs. That's the important thing.
Sure.
Jobs fell 90% from Obama's presidency. And now we're going negative on jobs.
Well, we'll talk more about the economy in a moment, if we may. But it's not true that his MAGA base has completely dropped off since the conflict in the Middle East, is it? I mean, there are some very vocal opponents to what he's done. We understand that the Democrats are opposed to it, too. But actually, there hasn't been a complete falling away at all.
No, there's a fissure. There's cracks in it. And until this second term in the White House, there were no cracks in the MAGA base. But we're now seeing very clear cracks and people are uncertain what to do. And you can see that in the by-elections that we've had, where a number of very tight to Donald and tight to MAGA Republicans have suffered losses. There are 35 of the roughly, I think it's 220 Republicans in the House who are not going to run again because they know they're going to lose. They're leaving Congress. But we're seeing are cracks or fissures, not a collapse.
Many people across the world really hope that there was an end game, and perhaps one that Donald Trump was simply a bit unwilling to share with everybody. That can happen in times of war. But what do you believe that he thought would happen 10 days ago?
Oh, Donald, who you have to understand is appallingly ignorant. One of the first things I learned when we first met almost 40 years ago. Donald doesn't think ahead. He's not a strategic thinker. He thought the U.S. military would just wipe out the leadership and then the Iranian people were going to amazingly rise up and overthrow this awful regime they live under. That there was no planning. There was nothing done to prepare and reach out to people who might overthrow the government. There was no planning for what are you going to do about oil. They didn't add to oil reserves around the world by announcing these things in advance. And this was all an air power effort, and air power is limited. Trump now faces the question, and he's talked a little bit about it in public, are we going to send ground forces? You would have to muster those. You'd have to transport them around the world. You have to bring all the heavy equipment, tanks, armored personnel carriers, landing, beach landing gear. And you would face a country that has a million trained soldiers, not all active duty, but a million trained soldiers.
But, David, what about all of the people who would have been around Donald Trump when he was discussing all of those things or simply stating his aim about all of those things? I mean, there would be dozens and dozens of people who would have expertise in all of those areas that you've just talked about. Do you believe that they feel the need now to lean in towards him so they don't speak their mind? Are they terrified of the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth? You know, what's going on with all of the bystanders?
Well, what's changed is in the first administration, there were a whole variety of people who, as you described them, experts in their fields and principled and constitutional. This time, Trump has surrounded himself with zealots, and many of these people are utterly unqualified. You know, his head of the FBI, no qualifications whatsoever, and he's been firing the very best FBI agents who worked on national security measures because they were involved in the investigation of Trump's theft of classified documents. Now, Donald has surrounded himself with yes men. And so he's hearing back what he wants to hear. Now, there are certainly some voices that are going to be practical. Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, is certainly going to remind him at every chance, you start a land war, that's going to really upset your base and a lot of other people who are not particularly upset with you, but not your opponents. And so he doesn't have that kind of, Mr. President, that's really not a good idea, people in the Oval Office and around him.
Mm. There was a chance, surely, David, that actually Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu could have got this right, in their view, if, in fact, the Iranian people had managed to rise up to overcome the Revolutionary Guard, to form an orderly and cohesive line behind somebody else. I mean, that's presumably, it seems difficult to say this now, but that could have happened. We could never have needed to have this conversation.
Absolutely true. Instead, what we've done is evoked patriotic impulses, even in people who don't like the theocracy they're forced to live under. They don't also want to be under the oppressive U.S. government as they view it. So this has not worked out for them at all. And they didn't do any advance work to reach out to these people, to organize them, to supply them with weapons. And remember, the Tehran regime has a 100% absolute monopoly on violence because it has all the weapons and it has a set of laws that allow it to just massacre people if it wants to intimidate its own people. We also shouldn't forget, Fee, that within 24 hours before the bombing began, the Iranians made an extraordinary offer. According to the diplomat who was handling the negotiations, the foreign minister of Oman, Mr. Badar, the Iranians agreed to all of Trump's demands about nuclear enrichment, and they offered him American oil companies being allowed to come back into Iran. And their theory was, this is a better deal than Obama got. He can go out and say, hey, see what a great negotiator I am. I got a better deal than Obama got in 2015. The response of attacking the country would clearly lead the regime to believe, oh, we're dealing with dishonest people who are savages.
Yeah.
You can't hear their word. You can't respect their word.
For as long as this conflict goes on, there is going to be beyond consternation in the global markets, not least about oil and the price of oil. And what would be your expectation of how Donald Trump weathers that storm back home if this really starts to dig into the American economy, which is founded on gas, really, isn't it, for daily life? What then happens?
Well, if the war goes on more than the 4 or 5 weeks that Donald put an end date on a war, of course, a war is not a package of cheese from the grocery store with a use-by date, then oil prices are going to rise very significantly. They could rise to over $150 a barrel. Some oil analysts have suggested to $200 a barrel. Japan and Korea, which have no oil of their own, are going to be deeply troubled. The Chinese have huge imported reserves in oil, in salt domes. They're drawing those down, but they're not at all happy about that. And in the U.S., because oil is a global commodity, if you have oil and you can sell it for twice the price by shipping it to Japan or Korea or Australia, you're going to do that. So gas prices will go way up. Diesel prices will go up. Liquefied natural gas will become much more expensive. So this will have a devastating effect on the U.S. economy, and that will certainly harm any chances that Trump will be able to keep control of the House or the Senate, even with all of the promised tactics to interfere with the election, like Trump's former chief of staff, chief advisor Steve Bannon, saying that we're going to have the military at polling places to intimidate people, which, by the way, is illegal in the United States.
Yeah. But
might they do it? Sure.
And what do you make of his language, David? I mean, increasingly, commentators do seem to be willing to say this is a guy who many people believe could be quite unwell. Sometimes when he goes off on one of his rambling speeches, or where he simply refuses to engage with a simple question and give what many people would want to see as an honest answer. And do you believe him to just be his brain to be well and truly past its sell-by date?
Well, Donald has a number of psychiatrists and psychologists have said something called frontal lobe dementia. That's different than the Alzheimer's, the one people think of first. And all of his behavior, including his motor skills when he walks, and you can see him lift one leg across the other and he walks in off at an angle, are indicative of that kind of dementia. And you don't recover from that. It just gets progressively worse. Combine that with Donald's narcissism, his belief he's always had, as long as I've known him, that he is special, that no one is like him, that all the rest of you, unless you are his helpers, you're just objects standing in the way of his greatness. And he has now said that he is the American dictator. He said that a year ago, and that he runs the whole world. And so you take his megalomania combined with the office he's in, and this is not a good prescription. And Donald doesn't know anything about the Middle East. If you just asked him a simple question, what's the difference between Sunni and Shia in Islam, and why does it matter to American national security? Donald would turn to talking about the drapes or walk away or say that's a stupid question because he doesn't have a clue.
Yeah, you wouldn't be the only person in the West who can't answer that question, though, David. And just a final thought. If actually this had gone according to Donald Trump's plan and the Iranian people had managed to free themselves from a horrendous regime, undoubtedly the world would be a better place without a regime that crushes its own citizens so much, as well as showing aggression to its neighbours. Would you have been able to say, well, actually, fair play, well done?
Oh, absolutely. If this had succeeded and the Ayatollahs were removed, I would be telling you this is an incredible thing that Trump has pulled off, and we should respect that. Let's also not forget that the regimes in Saudi Arabia under MBS, in Bahrain, and the other Middle Eastern countries are just as vicious dictatorships. They're just dictatorships aligned with Washington as opposed to Tehran, which is wants to destroy the great Satan.
Well, that's a conversation for another day, and I hope that we manage to have it. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist. His book, The Making of Donald Trump, is available now.
I found that very interesting, but not all that reassuring. It has to be said. Right, it's Times Radio. Your thoughts welcome. 0333 003 2353. Next, Vassos is here with some sport, and for once we've got some great news about British success in tennis. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
As the war in the Middle East enters its 13th day, Donald Trump claims the conflict with Iran has turned out to be easier than he thought. How he expects to de-escalate a spiralling situation in the region, though, remains to be seen, especially as ships continue to be targeted in the vital Strait of Hormuz. We'll look at that for you, and Rebecca Reed, author and journalist, and Liam Deacon, the communications consultant, will be here to discuss the biggest stories of the day.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
From the first note to the final twist, Rigoletto delivers iconic music and a gripping story at the Royal Opera House. Lust, betrayal, and revenge combine in this unforgettable five-star production featuring a world-class cast. Rigoletto returns from the 25th of March to the 23rd of April. Dare to be moved. Book today at rbo.org.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Let's talk tennis in the company of our sportsman, Vassos Alexander. Now, Jack Draper has had a very significant victory. He has beaten Novak Djokovic at the Indian Wells tournament. I should say that Jack Draper is the defending champion here, isn't he? But he recovered from a set down, clinched the victory, and he's now in the quarterfinals. So he's been off injured, hasn't he, for a while?
Yes, he has. He had bone bruising, which I'd not heard of before, in his upper left arm. And that left arm is his significant weapon. He wears one of those arm sleeves, which I always think makes you look more menacing when you're about to send down a 140-mile-an-hour serve. And he did plenty of that against Novak Djokovic. So he's had to adapt his play a little bit in the last 6 months or so working with a new coach. But yes, gripping and gruelling was how Tom Kershaw described the victory last night in the Times. It was 2.5 hours long, just over. And one of the rallies at the start of the third set was just, it just had a bit of everything. It was just wonderful to watch two players. I mean, maybe not at the peak of their powers, but you look at that rally and they absolutely seem... Novak Djokovic, who won the rally, was just lying on his back. Just, I need a timeout here at the end of that. Yeah. And there was a bit of that from both players, but it was a great match. Great for Jack Draper to sort of announce his return with a statement win like that.
Yeah, no, we should say, I thought that... You called it an arm sleeve, did you?
Yes.
When I first saw the image on thetimes.com this morning, I thought it was part of his outfit. I thought he had a vest, but then he had a significant gap on his shoulder, a sort of saucy gap on his shoulders.
I had to have a word.
When I got to work, I had to ask me all about it, and she explained that it was a...
quite en vogue now. When he was reaching the semi-finals of the US Open a couple of years ago, Jack Draper, he was, last year at Wimbledon, he was the number four player in the world, you know, and he seemed to be... So, like a few years ago, there's always like a... When these young players come through, players like Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz, they always talk about the dangerous floaters in the draw, these players that are clearly going to reach the top of the game. I remember when that was Andy Murray. Mm. I remember that when that was Roger Federer. You know, they're clearly destined for the top, and so you don't want to meet them on their way up early in a draw. And he was that for a while. Then he reached the top, or very near it, and then he got injured, unfortunately for him. But, you know, he's still only, 24 years old. He's still got plenty of his career ahead of him. And that arm sleeve that he sort of started this trend. Even Novak Djokovic was wearing one last night.
Yeah, OK. I mean, it's a bit like, are other footballers still cutting holes in their socks?
No, that's a Jack Grealish thing.
OK, because for a while that was everywhere, wasn't it?
When he was him.
Yeah, when he was actually Jack Grealish.
But aren't the sleeves often worn simply to keep the blood pressure at exactly the right kind of place? That's what I understood them to be, as well as worn for injury. So it's exactly the same principle, isn't it, as putting on those surgical stockings when you get on board a flight?
I would imagine it is, yeah. I would imagine it is, but it's only in the serving arm. But, I mean, you know, you look at tennis and you look at how much pressure must go. A friend of mine used to be a pretty competitive javelin thrower when he was a kid and young adult. He said that his whole system is just so one-sided now because he was so strong on his right and the left didn't have to do that much, you know, and it just... The forces that repeatedly throw in the javelin, and the tennis serve is not dissimilar.
No.
So you can see why they have to manage that with these sleeves and other medical things.
So Jack Draper did hold a press conference afterwards. What was his mood?
He said he was overwhelmed to beat his childhood idol. They've only met once before at Wimbledon in 2001. He won the first set. That was when he was just starting to be that dangerous floater. Crazy match, he said, but he's thrilled. Because as you say, he's the defending champion. So he's now the world number 14. But if he doesn't at least reach the final, those ranking points fall off your record. So yeah. It's important for him to go through. And to go deep. And it's also important for his psyche. He says he can play better, and I'm sure he can. But look, he's beaten the 38-year-old Novak Djokovic, who did play well. So a really, really good win.
And Djokovic is, 38. Is he just simply not considering retiring?
He's starting to consider it.
Okay.
You know, when he reached the final of the Australian Open in January, he said, I don't know whether I'll be back on this court. Australia, by the way, have just started to love him. Since they expelled him. But he's managed to turn that round. He's really charmed them. And he is. He's in this sort of autumn of his career, charming people wherever he goes. He doesn't take the losses too seriously like he used to. He's not petulant like he used to be. And he's still, comfortably the third best player in the world.
Oh, no, he's obviously a complete genius. Right, let's get the latest from the races in Cheltenham.
Cheltenham Festival Updates on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18 plus, gambleaware.org.
Loads of images in the paper today of your royals and their mates all having a great time down at the races.
So much tweed on display this year. Just tweed everywhere.
I feel the need for tweed.
That's brilliant.
Novices hurdle today at the Cheltenham Festival. So the Gold Cup always used to be on the Thursday. It used to be a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday thing, but for a couple of decades now, the Gold Cup is on the Friday. So the big festival sort of comes to a head tomorrow with the Gold Cup. So on this Thursday, we've had a 40-1 winner, which is fantastic news if you were on it. And two jockeys, Nico de Boinville and Declan Queeley, had a bit of a contretemps. Accusations of racial slurs ahead of the opening race, but they have now shaken hands. So all is back on an even keel at Cheltenham.
Right, I'm glad to hear it. Thank you very much, Vassos. Have a very good weekend.
And to you.
Right, let's have this.
Cheltenham Festival Updates on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18 plus, gambleaware.org.
That was very slick. Coming up, we're going to learn more about the neighbours who did their own investigations into their area's contaminated water and what happened next. It's just gone 3:30. First, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The new supreme leader of Iran has urged his neighbours in the Gulf to expel all Americans from the Middle East. The message, which was read by a newsreader on state television, also warned the essential global shipping route of the Strait of Hormuz must remain closed. Oil prices have briefly jumped above $100 again, despite the world's energy watchdog announcing the release of millions of reserve barrels. It follows new Iranian attacks on ships in the region, including two tankers off the coast of Iraq. The UK's Defence Secretary, John Healey, says he's considering options for defending shipping. Vandara Hari is the founder of Vanda Insights, which analyses activity in the energy markets.
The big question really is at what rate that oil is going to be released. By our calculations, perhaps at the rate of about 3 to 4 million barrels per day. So put that number against the 20 million barrel per day hole that is being created every day that this war goes on.
Meanwhile, the Foreign Office says it's temporarily withdrawing some of its staff from Iraq after a series of strikes in the country. And Israel has cancelled prayers after it reported missiles have landed near holy sites in Jerusalem. Elsewhere, the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch has accused Keir Starmer of misleading MPs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as British ambassador to Washington. The Prime Minister told the Commons three times full due process had been followed when asked about the peer selection last year. But documents released yesterday showed Lord Mandelson had access to classified information before his security clearance had been granted. A woman's been jailed for 13 years for forcing a teenage girl to work as a house slave for a quarter of a century. 56-year-old Amanda Wixon subjected her victim to years of abuse at a home in Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio. This spring, start your own story in Scotland. Step into a land where the views are wild, the welcomes are warm, and the magic is real. From lofty mountains to vibrant cities, explore Scotland's breathtaking landscapes and uncover our ancient history. And with an exciting range of cultural events and festivals to enjoy, spring is the perfect time to plan your escape. Write your own Scottish story this spring. Start your adventure at visitscotland.com/spring.
When you leave a gift in your will to guide dogs, where could it lead? It might lead to a mum and dad feeling hopeful about their child's future.
When we were told originally that Mabel was blind, I kind of envisioned that she wouldn't be able to do anything as she grew up.
I feel good about Mabel's future now. There's no limit on what she can do.
Your gift to guide dogs could lead to a future where lives are transformed. Find out how to make your life-changing will for free. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs. Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
You might not automatically know who I mean when I introduce Ash Smith and Peter Hammond, but they deserve to be household names. They are the two campaigners who've held the feet of the water companies to the fire for more than a decade. They met as neighbours in a village in the Cotswolds, brought together by a shared concern about the state of their local river, the Windrush. They realised that something had changed, the wildlife had gone, there were no more fish, and they looked to Thames Water for answers. What they found started them on a journey of discovery, which is now detailed in Dirty Business, a three-part series on Channel 4. Filthy rivers, sewage pumped into the sea, a total lack of accountability by the water companies, obfuscation from the Environment Agency, little response from government. It is an astonishing story. The programme also tells us about the death of Heather Preen. She was just 8 when she fell sick after playing on the beach at Dawlish in Devon, where there had been a sewage discharge by South West Water. She died of E. coli poisoning. The inquest recorded a verdict of death by misadventure. Now, Ash and Peter have been described as national heroes for their work, Ash was a former detective superintendent in the Met, Peter a professor of computational biology, and he used those skills to look at data which proved that water companies were not doing the job that we were paying for them to do. They joined us earlier today at Times Towers. I asked Peter to tell me about what we've already lost, what the River Windrush used to be like.
Well, in 2002, when I first moved here, the river was generally very clear. Occasionally in the summer, we'd get it slightly murky in a natural way. There would be, you can imagine those long waves of this ranunculus weed flowing, you know, in the river with the little white flowers on. We would have swans coming every spring, very often to make a nest and rear some, you know, cygnets. The garden that we share with two other neighbours is a big garden with the river flowing around it, full of wildlife, and much of that wildlife being supported by, you know, a healthy river.
And the healthy river is part of an ecosystem, isn't it? So all of the other animals, all of the other birds, they rely on the river being healthy in order for them to be there and be healthy themselves.
Yeah, I can tell you that. Yeah, I spent my life around rivers. As a former angler, I've spent my time around chalk streams like the River Kennet in Berkshire, and they are a thing of absolute beauty and a magnet. You see all of the invertebrate life that then gives birth to the dragonflies, the mayfly. So much of the food chain is rooted in that water, apart from the water itself. It's such an important feature. And you'll see it if you just make a little pond for your garden and just put clean water in it. Just watch the transformation. Just watch how life is drawn to it and starts to grow in it. And then try putting some dirty, polluted water there and see what happens. It's that simple to demonstrate.
We've got so much to talk about with what you two gentlemen found and have done over the last couple of decades. I mean, it's almost impossible to condense it into a 20-minute interview, but I wonder whether it would be helpful, just so we really make an impact with this, if you could describe, having told us what a beautiful river should be like, the very worst that you then ended up seeing because of the pollution that has gone into our rivers.
Well, I mean, it is tragic and shocking to see what happens when a river is truly abused by sewage pollution. And it can be a chronic effect. It's not so much that fish are going belly up, although this does happen in many, many cases. And we've filmed that, and some of that is shown in Dirty Business. Some of our footage shows those dead fish. Often it's about affecting the breeding capabilities. So slowly the river declines and slowly the water quality goes off, the weeds disappear, and the invertebrate life goes, the fish life drops down to very little, just hanging on, and the water becomes murky and it often becomes quite grey. And this is a familiar scene, but it happens slowly. And then you need to get a piece of video like we did. Very lucky early on that I was given a piece of video by a person who'd campaigned for against water abstraction. They'd had the river filmed specifically to look at the river. That's so rare, because mainly people are filming things going on the riverbank. And we could show beautiful, almost like as clear as tap water, with loads of big fish swimming around. The Windrush had been described as like an aquarium. And then when I was approaching the Environment Agency in the early stages, they were saying, no, that's just some old anglers with rose-tinted spectacles. It was never like that. And then I produced that video, and I was shocked when I had it converted to a modern file. I thought they've messed up the colour. Of course, they hadn't messed up the colour. That was how the gravel used to be, golden, pristine, clean, with colourful life all about it. And it, without that sort of record, we would have just been dismissed as that never actually happened. Mm.
Tell us about the data as well that you obtained using a Freedom of Information request, and what you felt about it when it came back.
Well, like many people, we started looking in the river at the quality of the river. But I felt that my skills could be better turned to getting data from the water companies, and that describes you know, whether they're operating their sewage works and their pumping stations properly. So Ash started off by requesting some data from the agency in Thames Water. And when the Thames Water came, it was, you know, just enormous spreadsheets with, you know, columns and rows of numbers. And so what I did, because this, you know, it's my professional training, I started to visualize the data, looking for patterns of normal behavior, of good operation, and then patterns in the data when actually the operation was poor and even, you know, in breach of permits and hence breaking the law.
And what you found, I mean, detailed so brilliantly in Dirty Business, is just this extraordinary thing that the water companies were doing, which was when their mechanisms didn't function properly, instead of mending them and protecting the environment, they simply pressed buttons that released sewage into the rivers. So effectively, we were all paying them to do a job and they were just opening the window and chucking shit out, weren't they?
So it's a slightly different arrangement, but pretty much as you described, they normally have a certain amount that they have to take to treatment. And then after, as the level gets above that, there's normally something like a weir where the excess flows over, sometimes into a settling tank. Sometimes they stop the sewage debris, the sanitary products and everything else that people see littered around riverbanks. Sometimes they stop that, but the toxic sewage pollution then goes into a watercourse into the river. And they were saying to start with, oh yeah, but it's just for a short amount of time. It's to stop sewage backing up into your home. What do you expect us to do? And then, and it's meant to be an exceptional circumstance, the exceptional rain. But we thought, well, it rained sometimes, but it wasn't exceptional. And then as we started to look at the data, we've been incrementally shocked, frankly. To start with, we discovered that they'd been dumping sewage at Boughton on the Water, a popular tourist place nearby, for over a week, 24 hours a day. We thought that was stunningly shocking. But since then, we've found up to virtually 6 months or even more sometimes of consistently dumping sewage. And that's not an aberration. There are many that you can find that have gone for over 3 months, 4 months, with some little breaks in between because they like to break it up sometimes. Real abuse of the law, illegal. They tried to normalise that. It's not normal, it's illegal, and it's doing huge amounts of damage.
Who is it who should have been making sure that that wasn't happening?
Well, obviously, the Environment Agency's job is to police the activities of the water companies, you know, in terms of guarding against abuse and pollution of rivers. But what we found very quickly was that although there was very detailed data available, they were just asking for summary data, which you couldn't possibly use to evaluate what was going on. So we immediately went straight for this detailed data, which just revealed thousands of illegal sewage spills. And I remember when I had to give evidence to the Environmental Audit Committee in the House of Commons, I stuck my neck out and said, I think it's 10 times worse than the agency know about. And then later I had to revise that. I got it wrong. I told them it's 20 times worse. So actually, you know, they didn't really have a clue about what was going on.
So is it also, as well as not having a clue about what was going on, something far more deliberate than that, actually? I would really love you both to explain how it can be that my sewage, your river, you know, Eve's river, what is the relevance of all of that to, say, a sovereign wealth fund in a Gulf state? Why are these two things connected?
Yeah. So privatisation came in 1989. And prior to that, there had been 10 years of deliberate underinvestment of the water industry. So many people's last memory of what publicly owned water was like wasn't that good because they hadn't been able to spend any money for 10 years. Privatisation came in to fix that. That was the promise it would bring in investment. What it actually brought in, it attracted so-called investors from all around the world because what we are is like 62 million captive customers who cannot give up water for January or something. We all have to use water. We have to use the sewage system. So they have a guaranteed stream of money. They had debt-free companies that had been given to them. And basically, they've treated it as a money extraction machine so that the promises of money being brought in were just false. People just bought sections of the company, which they would then sell on later, and they just used them in, even in the words of Thames Water's own independent valuer that was produced a piece of work for the recent High Court case for their financial troubles. That valuation report said, since privatization, Thames Water concentrated on taking money out in dividends and pretty much forgot that it had a job to do and to maintain the infrastructure. Slightly different words, of course, but that's the sentiment very clearly put. And that's what they've done. That's what all the companies have done. They've never, in Thames Water's case, the work done by Stanley Root, a former auditor from PricewaterhouseCoopers, who works with us, discovered that there's not been one single year since privatization when the shareholders put in more cash than they took out. And mostly they don't put any in. Everything is funded by the bill payer, and the bill payer has been taxed for providing that money. It's almost impossible for people to grasp that on first description, because you think, no way would a government ever let us be victim of a scam like that. But I can 100% assure you they have.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting that you say a scam. I mean, as you point out, we are a captive audience, aren't we? We can't take our business elsewhere. You know, the best way to deal with a scammer is through the course of the law, isn't it? Or taking away access to a market. So what are we all meant to do as that captive audience to deal with the scam?
Well, I think what we can do now is absolutely make it clear to our MPs, all of our MPs, that we object to being treated like this. It's not necessary. The government can intervene. That government has powers to do this. The way the companies have conducted themselves, it is in breach of the requirements of their licenses. They've not delivered the service they're required to deliver, and they've been taking money out regardless of that. They basically undermine the whole national infrastructure, which is quite a shocking thing to do. That's now obstructing the actual legitimate economy. It's obstructing house building. And the answer to it seems to be, from the current government, give the owners of the companies even more money in the hope that they will actually do something and some kind of benefit will trickle down while we pay once again for work we've already paid for. So I would say, really, object to your MP, because there is a movement going on at the moment with Windrush Against Sewage Pollution and a more national campaign of groups, which is called the Sewage Campaign Network. And we are lobbying hard for the truth to be given to the public, and so that the public can get some decision making back where it should be, in the interest of the country, not in the interest of the shareholders.
And of course, all of this, the problems of pollution, can have an absolutely terrible human cost, can't they? And I wonder whether you can just tell us a bit about what seems to have happened, and I'm just having to put that in there for legal reasons, at Dawlish Beach in Devon.
Well, actually, Ash has very much looked into the dealings of the Preen family. It was the Preen's family's daughter, Heather, who died. He has investigated the interaction between the coroner and the family, which is depicted in the film. So he maybe could say something about that.
Yeah, I think the depiction in the film in Dirty Business is very good. It shows what actually happened to 8-year-old Heather on that day. She walked through sewage that had been spilling. It is connected to E. coli 0157, which is that serious infection of bacteria that she got. That is a route for that sewage to arrive. There was not an adequate investigation done. I've looked at what happened. What seems to me to have happened has been highly, highly distorted version of an investigation that looked away from the obvious causes of sewage pollution And therefore, at the moment, you have South West Water saying there's no connection with them. Okay, there wasn't anything proven at the time, but there was enough information provided for the coroner to make very strong recommendations about ultraviolet treatment of sewage and signposting and alarming the public and warning the public to avoid this sort of pollution. So it is really serious and tragic. And the more that we're looking at that, people are coming forward since Dirty Business. More people are coming forward with stories that sound quite similar to the tragic story of Heather and also of Ruben Santa, the young man who got the disease that has really made his life so uncomfortable. So it's been a very, I think, cathartic experience as well for many people who experienced not only the obstruction from the Environment Agency that we saw, but also the sort of behavior that happened around infections of people that happened before and after Heather's death.
Yeah.
There's another aspect to that as well that isn't covered in Dirty Business, and that's antimicrobial resistance. So what people aren't realizing at the moment is that a sewage works is like a big pot of soup of, you know, of everything we excrete, all the bugs and the drugs. And many of those bugs will undergo genetic mutations, just like happened with the COVID virus. And some of those will be advantageous to resist the drugs that they're finding and interacting with. And then, of course, that's getting out into the environment. And another thing that people don't know about, if you don't treat sewage properly, microplastics get out into the rivers, then out into the seas. And these bugs with this resistant capability stick to those plastics, and then they go out into the ocean and they go out into the environment. So there's potentially something that could explode in the future where we suddenly discover that all of this antimicrobial resistance actually is coming out. It's riding on the back of the microplastics and is traveling around the world, or it goes into sewage sludge onto farmland. You'll get gulls, as you know, when they're cultivating the land, they land on the sewage sludge. They'll pick it up on the feet. They'll fly off and they'll transfer it somewhere else. So there's a kind of an insidious potential wave of ill health that could result from this antimicrobial resistance. Mm.
It's such shocking stuff that is detailed in Dirty Business. Is this government the right government to actually make a real change now?
Well, we hoped it would be. We had limited progress under the Conservative government. They did bring in quite a lot to develop transparency, and that has actually helped us as campaigners to do the job of the regulators, the kind of captive regulators that have been forced. And we're not criticising a lot of the staff, by the way. A lot of the staff working for the regulators, as you see in Dirty Business, trying to do the right thing. We're highly critical of the leadership, but that has the legislation did allow us to investigate and expose so much. And what we're seeing now with the latest proposal, the government's new vision for water, was based on a report that was meant to be independent, was absolutely the opposite of independent, that was set up by DEFRA itself, that then decided that what it needed to do was to make the water industry more attractive to the shareholders, more attractive to the people that are fundamentally behind everything that is wrong with it. And that's what we're seeing now in the proposals for the new law, the white paper, the new vision for water, making the regulators take a supervisory role. In other words, investing them in the problems of the water industry and investing their own success in that success. It's so insidious that we resist that entirely. It needs to be gripped. The reasons for the failure are obvious, and this government is turning away from them because of their overt relationship with huge, influential so-called investment funds that are actually really, really good at extracting money from people.
That is Peter Hammond and Ash Smith. And I couldn't recommend Dirty Business enough, actually. It's on Channel 4. It's only three episodes. It is meticulously cast
and scripted, and all of the families who've suffered because of this are completely in favour of the drama documentary. They're really supportive of it, and they say it's told their story well. It's a topic that's really got you going. Just a couple of your texts so far today. Phil says, please continue or stretch this interview with these water guys. It's just too interesting. Paul in Staffordshire says, what about a nationwide campaign to just stop paying the bills? Anne says, wonderful and necessary that you've brought the environment back into the equation, even if the media and politicians, along with Trump, Putin and the rest of the merry gang, don't give a damn. And Mark says, well done for letting this interview go on. Those participants' knowledge and your questions are very educational for us all. Top work. So do take a moment, if you can, to watch the documentary. And, you know, we're all in it together. We've got no choice, have we?
No, we haven't. You either pay your water bill or you get into extreme amounts of trouble.
Yes, which is an extraordinary position to be in as a customer.
Yeah, it's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio, Market Watch, in association with F&C Investment Trust. Listen to Times Radio to hear all the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Get insight, analysis and up-to-the-minute information to help you get the most from your investment portfolio. Times Radio, Market Watch. Throughout the day, every Monday to Friday, on Times Radio, in association with F&C. It's smart to start with F&C. Find out more at fnc.com. Capital at risk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, we've got some good news for discerning listeners to Times Radio, because we're not here on Monday.
That is the good news.
That's it. Bye-bye. No, but that is quite good news. The bad news is we're very much back on Tuesday. But who have we got
We have got the lovely Asma Mia.
She's back, everybody.
She is back. No stopping her.
Well, I know she's much missed. I'm not to in any way take away from Kate McCann's genius, but Asma had many admirers, so it's lovely that she's coming back to Times Radio here on Monday. And then I think she crops up again, doesn't she, when we're away for Easter.
Yep. So good news all round. I might stay in and listen.
Yes. Actually, yeah, I'll get some tips. Thank you all very much for being a part of the programme this week, as ever. Lots of messages, some fiery, some constructive, some just plain rude. But we look at them all and we're very, very blessed to have you with us on our audio journey between 2 o'clock and four, Monday to Thursday. Did that sound sincere?
It sounded very sincere.
Yeah.
I'm just going to fill the time with a couple of messages.
Go on.
This from Andy. This is a classic case of common knowledge in the industry. Government regulators and companies failing to live up to public expectations. It's too easy to blame the companies when governments refuse to allow bills to increase and the Environment Agency wasn't resourced enough to monitor sewage outflow. Another one that goes a little bit further from Don. The Tories knowingly defanged regulatory bodies so their pals in the rich gang could make oodles of jolly Thatcherism's rich legacy. I was surprised in the documentary about the people who invested and bought.
Who was it?
Well, so there's Macquarie, which is an Australian fund, basically, which made a considerable amount of money.
You don't say.
A couple of years ago, I think, through Thames Water. But there are sovereign wealth funds involved all over the place who looked at our water industry and thought, yeah, there's money to be made there. That's what they do. I mean, let's not be kind of ignorant or, you know, faux outraged about that. We live in a capitalist world. But it is quite strange when you think, do they really care about what's happening in the River Windrush? And it turned out that they didn't, Jane.
Our producer today was Felix Forbes, our technical operator. I mean, how he gets through working with us, neither of us really know. Ryan Boyden, but we're very grateful to him. John Pienaar is next with Drive. Have a good couple of days.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. A British base in Iraq has come under attack from Iranian drones, wounding a number of American soldiers, and oil prices have briefly jumped above $100 again, despite the World Energy Watchdog announcing the release of millions of reserve barrels. And coming up, the former chief executive of BP, Lord Brown, and the former UK ambassador to Iran, Sir Simon Gass. Join me to talk about the economic and geopolitical repercussions of the war in the Middle East. And how badly has Keir Starmer been bruised by the Mandelson scandal?
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. A base housing British and American troops in Iraq has reportedly been hit by Iranian drones, marking the third successful strike against UK forces since the start of the Iran war. It's understood some American troops were injured, but there were no British casualties. It comes as Iran's new supreme leader has urged his neighbours in the Gulf to expel all Americans from the Middle East. The message, which was read by a newsreader on state television, also warned the essential global shipping route of the Strait of Hormuz must remain closed. The Sun is reporting Mojtaba Khamenei was critically wounded in recent US-Israeli strikes, with a source telling the paper he's in intensive care. The world's energy watchdog is warning the war has created the largest supply disruption in the history of the global oil market. Brent crude topped $100 a barrel again after Iran appeared to carry out further attacks on cargo ships in the Gulf. Two tankers were hit off the coast of Iraq while a container ship was struck near the UAE. The UK's Defence Secretary, John Healey, says he's considering options for defending shipping. Senior Associate Fellow at RUSI, Michael Stevens, told Times Radio Tehran is causing maximum disruption for minimal cost.
The Iranians have certainly made the calculation that whenever it looks like Trump is going to declare victory, they just keep him entertained a little bit longer. They just keep the problem going a little bit longer and they maximise the disruption. And this seems to be their tactic. Cling on in there. Bat for a draw, for those of you that follow cricket. And that's what they're essentially doing. They're not losing. They're never going to win. They're not losing. And the longer that they don't lose, the more time the US spends sucked into keeping the straits open.
The Conservative leader has accused Sir Keir Starmer of misleading MPs over the appointment of Peter Mandelson as British ambassador to Washington. The Prime Minister told the Commons three times full due process had been followed when asked about the peer's selection last year. But documents released yesterday showed Lord Mandelson had access to classified information before his security clearance had been granted. The Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, says the PM's position is untenable.
What Keir Starmer is right now is a hostage to Labour MPs. He is doing anything that he can to please his backbenchers rather than doing what is right for the country. I want someone who puts the national interest above their party interest. I think Keir Starmer right now is only thinking about the Labour Party, and that is not what we need in a leader.
Speaking to journalists in Northern Ireland this afternoon, the Prime Minister said he takes full responsibility for the appointment. A Sussex police officer will appear in court tomorrow charged with historical sex offences. Samuel Davis has been charged with the rape of a teenage girl and the sexual assault of another child. Both incidents are alleged to have taken place when Davis was a teenager and before he joined the police. The 21-year-old has been suspended from duty. A mother of 10 who forced another woman to be her family's slave for more than 25 years has been sentenced to 13 years in prison. Amanda Wixon, who's from Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire, subjected her victim to years of abuse and made her live in squalid conditions. The woman was just 16 when she moved into the house and was regularly beaten with a broom. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. It's fair to say, I think, that the war in the Middle East isn't going to plan. Actually, it's more than fair. It's obvious. And that is because it's more than obvious now that President Trump doesn't have a plan, at least no plan objectively worth the name. Ships and tankers under attack in the Iran war. Vital traffic along the Strait of Hormuz as good as blocked. Oil and petrol prices rising despite emergency measures to manage the market. Missiles and drones striking America's allies in the Gulf. And again overnight, Donald Trump has been saying that Iran is beaten and the war is as good as won. Iran doesn't seem to have got the memo, gloating about causing havoc on oil markets, driving up inflation in Western economies. So today on Drive, we're looking at what's really going on. What happens when even the most powerful country on earth launches a war without a clear plan or an assessment of its implications or a notion of what would become of Iran and the Middle East when it is over? I wonder what you are thinking. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, let us talk to Sir Simon Gass. I had a chat with him just ahead of the show. He's a senior advisor to Overseas Strategy. He's also a former UK ambassador to Iran, as well as being a former chair of the British government's Joint Intelligence Committee. Our conversation went like this.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you look back at the history of the Islamic Republic, it is absolutely rooted in a strong sense of defiance, of survival, of sacrifice, and of hostility to the United States and to Israel. So although it may be true that the United States and Israel are wreaking huge damage on Iran's military capability and some aspects of its infrastructure, so far as we know, the roots of the regime are still intact, and it is showing no signs of wanting to capitulate in the face of American pressure. And I have to say that anybody who thought that it would be otherwise has probably not really studied Iran as carefully as they should have done.
Right. And so what are the lessons that ought to have been drawn from history and experience? I think you take the view that Iran was ready for the American attack when it came. And even though we hear the president and those around him tell us that they have decapitated their regime, they've cut away the level below the top level, Iran had that in mind when they were preparing for the onslaught.
Well, I'm sure that is right. Iran has been expecting, the leadership in Iran has been expecting a resumption of Israeli and possibly Israeli and American attacks since the conflict which we saw in June of last year. So this has not come as a surprise to the Iranian regime, even if they didn't know exactly what the timing would be. The result is as expected. And what that means is that they have prepared not only in terms of defensive military capability, but also by making sure that their chain of command has alternates, so that if somebody is killed, then there is an automatic successor to that post, and therefore it's as seamless as possible. This shouldn't delude us into thinking that life is not extremely hard for the Iranian military at the moment. They face all sorts of difficult problems, including some number of desertions, no doubt, and shortages of munitions of different types. Nevertheless, they are not in a condition in which they would now feel that they needed to surrender to the United States.
Yeah, and we're interested in talking a lot today about Iran's, I don't know, ace in the hole, to use that expression, and that is the